case of the day, and that is 05C801, and it's Bolton versus Yurkovich. And it's Mr. York. Hi, Mr. York. And I'm going to get to thank someone again. This is so exciting. All right.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Ethan York, and I represent the appellant Anthony Bolton in this matter. In March 1997, Mr. Bolton was convicted of first-degree murder following a two-day bench trial in the Circuit Court of Cook County, for which he is now serving the 18th year of a 50-year prison term. There was no physical evidence pointing towards Mr. Bolton as the culprit of this crime. Rather, he was convicted based upon the testimony of two individuals, a minor co-defendant and the victim's girlfriend, who had identified Mr. Bolton as the shooter the night of the crime.
Has Mr. Bolton ever denied that one of the four men in that car pulled the trigger?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question. He was asked whether or not he had pulled the trigger or was involved in the crime, and he said no.
See, what I've been thinking about is that if we know that one of the four was the shooter, it would seem that the different appearances of the four men would make that identification more reliable, not less reliable. In other words, in the usual lineup, what we're doing is we're comparing the suspect against the world. So, you know, we want them to look alike or as much alike as possible. But in this case, we're comparing Mr. Bolton only to the four people who were involved in the shooting. So why wouldn't that be a more reliable identification?
Well, I have two answers to that question, Your Honor. First, I don't believe that that it's necessarily presumptive that it was one of the four people that were involved in this case. And second, I think that Your Honor's presumption goes right to the problem of a suggestive lineup, allowing the police to justify their arresting decisions of a group of people by having a suggestive lineup saying, we don't know which one of these four did it, but we think it's one of these four. So we're going to play police, prosecutor, and jury here, and we can't get it wrong. By the justification, as long as our witness picks one of these four individuals, that is going to be consistent with our arresting decision and who we believe is guilty of this crime. And I believe that is one of the problems why the National Institute of Justice has said you don't just keep all four people or just people that are accused of this crime in the lineup, because then the police get the answer that they perhaps want.
Well, but, like, I mean, it seems to me that she wasn't likely to accidentally pick the, you know, 6'4", 300-pound man or the 5'7", 130-pound man or the teenager.
Well, Your Honor,
if all of the four men in the car had looked alike, then it would be harder for her to pick the shooter. But I was under the impression that we knew that one of the four men did it, and that that would make her identification more reliable. But what you're saying is we don't know that one of the four men did it.
No, the story from my client, the appellants, is that they entered into this housing complex and were then stopped by the police. There is not the idea that Mr. Bolton, the appellant, had not suggested that one of the other three was the shooter. Although one of the co-defendants did point towards Mr. Bolton as a shooter, you have to remember that there was no physical evidence tying Mr. Bolton or any of the three to the crime. The guns that were recovered were conclusively found not to be the guns used in the murder by the state's forensic scientist. Mr. Bolton was found shortly after the crime occurred not to have any gunshot residue on his hands.
Almost immediately after.
Almost immediately after. You're correct, Your Honor. They were stopped within 10 minutes of the shooting and arrested. One of the co-defendants fled And that was a co-defendant that fled because he said he had a weapon and was trying to avoid being caught for that. The two co-defendants, the non-minors, were eventually convicted of weapons possession. But neither one of those weapons were the murder weapon. That's conclusively proven.
But I would like you to back up, actually, to the question whether this manner of criticizing the lineup was ever presented by Mr. Bolton to the state courts, because, you know, I hardly need to tell you, you know, that habeas is not the world's easiest path for someone to take these days, and you've done a nice job in your reply brief trying to address this, but here's my issue, really. When this court issues a certificate of appealability, we are saying, or the district court, whoever issues it, is saying, we think there is a substantial constitutional issue here, but we're giving the green light for that to get explored. Motions panels or motions judges usually don't bind a later merits panel, and I'll speak personally, if I were to think that the minute I granted a CA, a huge array of other issues had been resolved, I might be more unwilling to grant certificates of appealability. I might want to think, boy, this is really a very consequential move, instead of just giving the green light to the next stage. So I'm not satisfied that this has all been resolved, and I am concerned about this messy record. It looks to me, I'll tell you, as though Mr. Bolton was pro se on a couple of occasions, trying to say it was a suggestive lineup. His lawyers then drop it. He's got a lawyer sometimes. He doesn't have a lawyer sometimes. Somebody cites Stovall against Deno, which is great, but this is a very difficult record.
I understand. If I can address that, Your Honor, I do believe in this case what the standard would say is that was Mr. Bolton, as a pro se appellant or someone pursuing his post-conviction relief, did he raise the issues that would call to mind the challenges of the constitutional right implicated here? And not only was Mr. Bolton perhaps ineloquently, but consistently throughout his state court proceeding as well as in the federal district court, was calling to mind exactly the issues that were raised in appellant's brief. Despite him talking about the issue of whether or not there was prosecutorial misconduct, that dealt with the photographs regarding the lineup. When he was talking about ineffective assistance of counsel, he was talking about whether or not there was a proper challenge to the lineup. Mr. Bolton used terms that the lineup procedure was improperly suggestive, quote, unfairly suggestive, was a deprivation of his due process rights. When this court granted the COA, it said that a constitutional right had been he had made a strong showing regarding the implication of his due process rights associated with the police lineup identification.
Well, right. And I want to back away from that for a minute, because you're right. I mean, he uses language occasionally in the record, although it's really during his first direct appeal, where he doesn't take the PLA to the Illinois Supreme Court, that this language comes in. He's got a letter to the state trial judge in which I think he's mistaken, but he says my lawyer had filed for a motion to suppress identification back in May, and he's worried that this isn't being followed up on. You see Raymond Clark's lawyer, in fact, filing such a motion, claiming this kind of problem with the lineup. No persons or an insufficient number of persons reasonably similar to the defendant. So it looks like Mr. Bolton maybe clumsily is trying to raise that. But I am not, when you think of Baldwin against Reese, when you think of other cases, it's not clear to me that the state courts got a fair shot at looking at this issue.
Your Honor, I think that why I believe that they got a fair shot looking at the issue is that one issue that, especially on the post-conviction proceedings, that Mr. Bolton was heavily pressing was the information regarding the consideration of this newly discovered evidence. That evidence regarding whether or not Ms. Smith, it was suggested to Ms. Smith that she did not know who the shooter was and that she pick out Mr. Bolton, goes directly towards the kind of the procedural constitutional a claim of innocence.
Well, in a generic sense, it might make you think about that, but it's a different flaw with the lineup. If the police whisper in your ear, you know, pick number three, that's one thing. If the lineup includes only one person remotely similar to the, we suppose, of course, Ms. Smith never gives a description of the shooter, but you've got the 300-pound man all the way down to, you know, the skinny teenager. That's a different kind of problem. It makes me think about Neal against Biggers. It makes me think about Stovall. It makes me think about a different line of cases.
Well, I think I agree with that, Your Honor. And the other aspect of your concern, I believe, can be addressed by saying that the standard is whether or not the ineloquence or clumsily fashion in which Mr. Bolton put forth these arguments called to mind the particular constitutional right and the issues at hand.
Right.
And he used such language and did it in such a way that the court, in instances, could see this is the issue here, and that could address it. And this court, when reviewing Mr. Bolton's request for a COA after the district court denied it, did not limit it to the issue of whether or not the particular instances of the production of the photographs or the particular words that Mr. Bolton used, but made it such that it was the issue of the constitutional deprivation associated with this police lineup identification. And in this case, that invited the appellant in this case to explore this and to talk about the identification in whole. It's not as if the issue is brand new, raised for the first time. It was raised below, and it was raised in such a way that it would bring to mind exactly the issues that perhaps we're now seeing more explicitly and perhaps being with headers in the briefs, but that Mr. Bolton had been kind of banging his fist for 15 years about. Although he perhaps or his counsel weren't saying it exactly as we're saying it now, this was the issue that he said, I was convicted based upon a bad lineup. And he might have said, you know, that manifested itself in a concrete way in that I don't have the pictures, which would have proven it was unduly suggestive, or something along that lines. But what he was complaining about was that my conviction was unfairly based upon this lineup. And it was done at the beginning of the process, right after I was arrested. And as this court has said in U.S. versus Wade, or the Supreme Court has said in United States versus Wade, that's really where it counts. That is where it follows through and has this consistent pattern that once a witness identifies someone in a lineup, it kind of goes through the end of the trial. And that's why this is such a dangerous and important question for this court to consider. Because although the courts below might have found that the witness on the stand was reliable in her identification of Mr. Bolton as the culprit here, this is after she was not reliable in picking him out of a lineup. This is after the crime occurred, unable to describe him in even the most fundamental way. That she had previously said that she thought the culprit was a man that she knew named Stephen, that she was getting pushed down on a floorboard by her boyfriend, that shots were ringing out, and that the police described her as hysterical. Now, longer after that point, after she is maybe then perhaps suggested by police to pick out Mr. Bolton, it's not surprising, nor do the courts find it surprising, that she would again say, it was Mr. Bolton, that man there. She now has the time advantage to say that, it was dark out, but streetlights helped me out. This is time after she perhaps had time to prepare for testimony. And she's also testifying against the man that shot her boyfriend, according to her. All of these instances were tainted by the original suggestive lineup. Mr. Bolton clearly was not given a fair shake here regarding the lineup identification. This court has found time and time again that if the physical characteristics or the composure of the lineup does matter. And especially in this case, and found in particular cases dealing with height and weight, that this type of disparate between, as we said in our brief, large, medium, small, and teen, really disadvantage the person in the middle, especially for the identifying witness that had previously been unable to describe the perpetrator in any sense of the fashion. If you are unable to identify someone in any particular fashion because of a specific characteristics, it's a reasonable conclusion to think that you might pick in the middle. And that's unfortunately where the appellant fell in this. Also, in this case, it was only made up of the four individuals that were arrested by the police, and this supported their arresting decisions. When you then take into account that there was newly discovered evidence from that there was an affidavit that the police said in earshot of Ms. Smith that she can't pick out who the shooter is, she can't identify him, we're going to have him pick Mr. Bolton. The courts below erred in considering that, because this is not an issue of whether it goes to actual innocence, but goes to what this court has said is acceptable for the court's consideration of whether or not that this type of evidence goes directly to a constitutional violation. And right here where I see my time has expired, so I'll wrap it up, but especially in a case where the entire structure of the conviction was based upon one person's testimony, as the trial court here had said upon ruling, that it is extremely important that this identification be questioned. I appreciate your court's time, and we ask that this court reverse the course below and order that Mr. Bolton's petition for habeas relief be granted. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. York. Okay. Mr. LeVin, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Eric Levin on behalf of the appellee, Warden Yurkovich.
Can I just start you right out? Has Mr. Bolton ever denied that he was in the car with the shooter? Has he ever denied that the shooter was one of the four men in the lineup?
No, Your Honor, I don't think he has ever denied that. He did not testify at trial. So I don't think he's denied anything. And the other evidence presented at trial suggests that these four men were the four who were there, and one of them was the shooter. That's consistent with Marcus Flowers' testimony. It's consistent as well with Ms. Singleton's testimony. She was the neighbor across the street who testified that she heard a commotion and saw a group of men immediately before the shooting, and then if you combine that...
Did she mention how many were in the group?
I don't know if she mentioned exactly how many were in the group, but it's if you combine her testimony, so she's sort of the witness who sees this immediately before, if you combine that with the testimony of the officers who are on the scene immediately and see the car with these four individuals in it, together the circumstantial evidence is fairly strong that these four were involved in the shooting, and it was one of them who was the shooter.
Why does her testimony help you?
Ms. Singleton?
A group can be 3, 4, 5, 8, 11, 412.
Well, I don't think it makes our case definitively by any stretch, but I think it's one piece of the puzzle when combined with the officer's testimony, when combined with Marcus Flowers' testimony, and then finally when combined with Brandy Smith's testimony. I think all of them together indicate that this was a group of these four individuals who were involved, and one of them was the shooter. And then, of course, we have two witnesses who testified that shooter was Mr. Bolton. And if I could briefly get to your point.
I just have one other question for you, because was he tried only under a theory that he was the triggerman, or was he also tried under an accomplice theory?
No, the state's theory that he was the triggerman. And so
despite the fact that it was Flowers who had the gun residue, not Mr. Bolton.
Well, the gunshot residue test with respect to Flowers was inconclusive. It showed slightly elevated
right,
levels.
Right, and it was conclusive for Mr. Bolton that there wasn't any.
Yes, but that is true. We don't.
And he was captured very quickly, not in time to run into his apartment and scrub off his hands.
True. There's no evidence in the record, however, of essentially what it takes to scrub gunshot residue off of one's hands. We don't know, perhaps rubbing his hands against his pants or against his shirt would do it. That evidence is simply just not in the record.
Well, I have to tell you, my view of this case is that although the state has a set of very important procedural arguments having to do with the scope of the habeas corpus statute, if there is ever a lineup that has seemed unconstitutionally suggestive to me, it's this one. The underlying merits, I think, are terrible for the state.
Well, Your Honor, I think, and this goes to Judge Rovner's point, this is not the prototypically suggestive lineup where you have three individuals who look, where you have one individual who essentially stands out like a sore thumb, and it suggests to the witness that he's the one who did it. Here we have a case where, according to petitioner's own allegations, and there is some dispute between his allegations in state court where he claimed that one of these four men was not in the lineup, but now he claims that person was. But according to those allegations, essentially three of the four all look different. We don't know what Marcus Flowers' height and weight were. So there's no reason to think necessarily that the composition of the lineup in that manner suggested to Brandy Smith that Bolton was the person she should pick out. It
this
might
is like a show-up case, actually, much more than like a lineup, though. You don't have any description from Brandy Smith. She's told, you know, look at these guys. She probably reasonably thinks one of them, the police have some reason to think one of them did it.
Well, I actually think that's an important point, that she didn't make an identification on the scene. And it's not that she was asked to and couldn't. The testimony is from the officers is that they didn't ask her at the scene.
No, she was crumbled on the floor screaming, they said.
Well, yes, but she got a look at him quite clearly before that. And so it's
and she flips and flops back and forth. I mean,
well, but, Your Honor, I also think another important point, however, is even if this claim had been raised in state court, and even if the court had found the lineup suggestive, the second step would be, is there independent reliability to the identification? And there are factual findings made by the state courts, not on this claim, obviously, because it wasn't raised, but in the course of adjudicating the sufficiency of the evidence.
Well, I'm not sure if it wasn't raised or it wasn't discussed. It certainly wasn't discussed by the state.
I think
courts.
It was raised.
I think, well, an important point here, Your Honor, is that at this point, well, I think, Judge Wood, you sort of hinted at this, is that anything, to the extent he raised a suggestive identification claim, and to the extent he put before the state courts the controlling legal principles of a suggestive identification claim, the closest he came to doing that was in his direct appeal. And he didn't file a subsequent PLA, so essentially that all is really beside the point for our analysis.
I understand how the whole game of cards works.
I mean, I understand the habeas can be tricky, but he had a lawyer on his direct appeal. He had a lawyer filing his post-conviction petition.
It's clear that, you know, it certainly seems clear that this appeal is the first time that, you know, the issue of the different appearances of the other men in the lineup have been, raised. But why shouldn't we address the merits of the argument as it relates to the detective's suggestion that she select the man in the dark pants? And why not consider the affidavit, too? He raised that in the state court, he raised it in the district court as well.
But both the state court and the district court quite reasonably interpreted that as being an actual innocence claim, which is permissible under Illinois law. And the exhaustion requirement, along with the related fair presentment requirement, are crucial to AEDPA. It's at the core of the AEDPA. The Supreme Court has recently gone to pains to reiterate that the AEDPA channels primary responsibility for resolving constitutional claims in the state courts. And the only way to effectively implement that procedure is to require petitioners to fairly present their claims. And that, as this court has said in some of the cases we cite, it requires a concrete, practical analysis of whether the petitioner sufficiently alerted the state courts to the constitutional claim he later presents in federal court. And I think reviewing the state court briefs, it's just clear that he was not raising, particularly when we take out the direct appeal because he didn't file the PLA. The only question then is, did he, throughout the complete round of post-conviction review, fairly present, and that means both the controlling legal principles as well as the operative facts, of the suggestive identification claim he's now raising.
What about Martinez against Ryan? Of course, his post-conviction counsel does him a huge disservice by deleting the reference in his pro se petition to the suggestive nature of the lineup. And when counsel actually torpedoes your best claim, isn't there something in Martinez that would suggest that the federal habeas court can hear a claim?
No, Your Honor. I think there's two reasons. Martinez, by its terms, was quite clear that it applies only to excuse the default of an ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim. And here there's no argument that petitioner has defaulted an ineffective assistance claim. He's defaulted a suggestive lineup claim. And which brings me to the second point. Martinez applies only if the claim that has been defaulted was a claim that could only have been raised for the first time in post-conviction proceedings. This is a claim that could properly and should have been raised on direct appeal. It should have his trial counsel failed to file a motion to suppress, and his direct appeal counsel was then sort of hemmed in, but, you know, didn't. He could have perhaps argued plain error, but he didn't bring the suggestive identification claim on direct appeal. Now, if he had, and he's never raised in state court or in his federal habeas proceedings an ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim. So that claim as well has just simply not been preserved for review. If I could, simply getting back to the merits, because I understand there's some concern with that. Again, this might be a different matter, you know, assuming it had been preserved and the state courts had a chance to adjudicate it. We would then obviously be under 2254D, which is another consequence of the failure to have raised it in state court. Now, my opponent never really acknowledges the fact that there simply hasn't been an adjudication of this claim in state court. And I think...
Well, if he raised it and the state courts just passed it by, then typically you go back to the pre-EDPA, which are still very deferential standards. But if he had raised it properly, the state courts can't just ignore it.
True, but there's no indication here...
I mean, they can ignore it, but the consequence is that the review standard's a little different.
There's no indication here, however, that these courts ignored it. I mean, at this point, we have essentially four separate state courts have looked at his pleadings, as well as the district court. Not one of those courts interpreted his pleadings as having raised the suggestive identification claim. Moreover, at no stage after a state court perhaps, you know, allegedly overlooked this claim, according to him, did he petition for rehearing? Did he move for reconsideration? In his post-conviction PLA, for instance, he didn't allege that the state appellate court had overlooked his claim. All of these things together are fairly strong evidence that not only did he not present a suggestive identification claim, particularly
He was trying to present it. His lawyers weren't doing it for him. He mentions it repeatedly throughout these proceedings.
Well, a lot of what he's mentioning is sort of cribbing or cutting and pasting from his direct appeal brief.
But he's still laying it out. He's still saying it was suggestive in the lineup.
But even still, even to
it doesn't matter that he cuts and pastes. He gets it out there.
Well,
it's in the petition.
I think the only mention of Stovall is in the direct appeal brief. I don't think he mentions that in his post-conviction proceedings. But even to the extent there that he put forth some controlling law governing a suggestive identification claim, fair presentment also requires that he present the state courts with the operative facts of the claim. And so it's essentially similar to this court's cases saying that a portion of an ineffective assistance claim can be defaulted, even though the petitioner argued ineffective assistance and cited Strickland, if he didn't also give the state court the facts under his claim so that he gave them a chance to adjudicate it. There was no mention throughout his state proceedings of the lineup being suggestive because the participants look so different. His claims even there were that it was suggestive, one, because they were all instructed to raise their hands, and two, because Brandy Smith was allegedly told who to identify. Although even there we have the state courts did make a factual findings there in the course of adjudicating the sufficiency of the evidence claim that her testimony was, you know, she might have misspoke at one point, but she was quite clear both before and after that she was not instructed who to identify, and that was corroborated, of course, by Detective Bernatek's testimony.
What's he going to say?
That he didn't. Well, it is testimony, and the state courts did make factual findings with respect to it, and the petitioner hasn't come forward with clear and convincing evidence that would rebut that, the presumption of correctness. But I think ultimately, as I said, it's the claim is simply both forfeited and procedurally defaulted because it just simply wasn't presented to the state courts. And that really is one of the core functions of AEDPA is to channel these cases to the state courts and to give them the first opportunity to correct any potential constitutional problems with their convictions. And where they aren't given that chance, we can't then hold it against the state courts that they didn't adjudicate these claims. They weren't fairly presented with them. Just briefly, I'll touch on the argument that my opponent makes that we forfeited or waived these arguments by not objecting to the CA. I think, first of all, I think there's both a flawed factual premise to that argument and two flawed legal premises. The flawed factual premise is that the CA has to be read in context. So even the CA prefaced the grant of permission to appeal with the statement that the court had reviewed the final order of the district court and the record on appeal. Even if it hadn't said that, it only makes sense to think that a certificate granting permission to appeal must be read in the context of the history of the litigation and the procedural posture. And so in a case where a claim, it doesn't make sense to interpret a certificate of appealability as granting permission to appeal an issue that had never been raised throughout the course of the litigation. And I think there is certainly no reason for us to have foreseen that the petitioner would read the CA that way.
Well, look, the certificate of appealability isn't that hard to read. I'm sure you knew exactly what issue it was certifying, and you responded, as you're entitled to do, with some procedural arguments saying we shouldn't reach that issue. But you knew. There's nothing ambiguous at all about the CA.
To be honest, Your Honor, the language of the CA says that it finds the denial of a constitutional right in connection with the admission of the lineup. All of the claims that were in the petition are connected to the admission of the lineup. I honestly read the CA as certifying the three claims in the petition. I simply didn't foresee that he would read it as granting permission to appeal a claim that hadn't been either presented to or addressed by the district court. But even if the certificate clearly had certified appeal of an issue that wasn't presented below, there's no obligation for the state to object pre-briefing. The cases my opponent relies on, which talk about the state waiving issues with the CA if they don't bring them to the court's attention immediately, are issues that go to the facial sufficiency of the CA under 2253 or under SLAC. So, for instance, if the court grants a certificate only on a procedural question and the state doesn't bring that to the court's attention immediately, the court quite rightly says, well, the CA serves a gatekeeping function. We're already through the gates. We might as well address the claim. Here, had I filed a motion arguing that the CA was somehow improper because the claim was forfeited and defaulted, my motion would have been 35 pages long, just as my brief was on that issue. My opponent's response would have been 30 pages, and I think it's quite likely the motions panel would have said, save this for your brief. So, the implications as well of my opponent's argument are fairly remarkable. It would require the state in all cases to bring all their default and forfeiture arguments to the motions panel immediately rather than saving them for the brief out of fear.
So we have to thank you for saving us 65 extra pages.
You could say that, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, we would ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court denying habeas relief. Thank you.
Mr. York, sure. How much time? Please give him another 3 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honors. I'd like to address especially one of your concerns, Ms. Rovner, Judge Rovner, I'm sorry.
Mrs. Rovner, I liked that title better.
That you had addressed about whether or not Mr. Bolton or anyone else for that matter had denied it was one of the four. And after a chance to reflect on that, I can point to a couple things that would answer that question. Specifically, Marcus Flowers. Judge Wood, you had said that that Ms. Smith had flip-flopped. Talk about flip-flopping. Marcus Flowers, who did have gunshot residue on his hands, had testified at trial after the removal of threat from the police that none of the four people who were in that car were the trigger people. What he said is he had gone into the London Town Housing Projects and had left without incident when they were arrested. asked why he had previously signed a statement that Mr. Bolton, he said, I was 16. I asked to talk to my mother. They wouldn't let me do it. They told me all sorts of things, like I was going to go away for 30 years. This is also a person who had found trace residue of gunshot residue on his hands. After the threat of police is removed, he changes his testimony completely and says this was none of the four. He then flip-flops and goes back and says, okay, now I'm going to tell the truth. It was Mr. Bolton. What happened between his time on cross-examination and redirect? Who knows? But he changes his testimony at least three times. Another person who says it wasn't any of the four was Miss Smith. She says that she only saw two people. Your Honor, Judge Robner, you had asked whether or not she had identified it as these four. She said she saw two people, people on the right-hand side of her car and somebody on the left. She originally thought the trigger man, even though she said later at trial, much later, that she got a clear look at the person's face, that it was the acquaintance of her named Stephen. So she also identifies a second group of people who this could be. And as Mr. Bolton did not testify but pled not guilty to this, he also denied that it was himself or somebody else within these four people, four groups, the four men that were arrested as part of this group. Also, going back to the question of the CA and the issues raised in this appeal, the issues identified for this appeal was that Mr. Bolton had made a substantial showing of the denial of one of his constitutional rights associated with the police lineup identification. There's a clear nexus between what Mr. Bolton had previously argued, the CA, and what is raised in this brief. As Judge Wood had recognized, not only was the language used to determine that he was questioning the suggestiveness of this lineup, he continued to do that throughout. Again, perhaps clumsily, perhaps ineloquently. But this is the type of suggestive lineup that led to a bogus identification, which leads to the conviction. This is the type of wrong that habeas petitions are intended to correct. So we ask that you reverse the court below and order that Mr. Bolton's petition for habeas relief be granted. Thank you.
Mr. York, thank you, and your friends at table and everyone at Winston and Strawn for your taking on this case. And, of course, the case will be taken under advisement. I'd like to say one other thing, and it's this. Today, everyone that's here in the courtroom was given a very special privilege of seeing two truly, truly fine lawyers. And I just want you to know that I think all of our hearts are beating a little faster. So thank you for that gift.
Thank you.
And the court is going to be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:30.